Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic.
Patty.
I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm wondering if we can get that CD and put it on for now. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. The 25th anniversary of Miracles Happen, I think, is spectacular, and I want to thank you for inviting me and allowing me to participate. I don't know what year I was past chair. I was trying to figure it out, 93. I knew Dan would know. I looked in the program hoping it was going to be in there. I was in there looking at the flags, thinking, what flag was it? I couldn't remember. And it's because I'm old. I couldn't remember. But somebody just told me the other day about coconut oil. So if you take coconut oil, it keeps you from getting Alzheimer's. I'm hoping it's not too late, so I'm going to start on coconut oil. But miracles happen. There's a lot of memories for me. I think my only significant relationship in Alcoholics Anonymous started in that parking lot up there. And well, not in that sense, but I've had it's just, this has been miracles happen for me has just been a very important part of my sobriety, and I'm just really touched to be here with you and have an opportunity to share a little bit. Whenever I share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm given a simple direction, and the direction is tell him your name and tell him the truth. And I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. The story I would like to tell you is I would like to tell you that I was a Kansas City housewife. I sat on the sofa, drank a little white wine. One day I burnt the toast and realized my life was unmanageable. So I rushed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked at the 12 steps. I knew they were the solution to the problems in my life. Worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And that's the story I'd like to tell you. I was responsible one time for a fire that gutted the entire inside of the house. And I imagine somewhere in that house there was a loaf of bread. And consequently... consequently, I did burn the toast, but it wasn't enough to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a blackout drinker, so what it used to be like is a little sketchy. Coupled with the fact that I didn't pay a lot of attention. I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I didn't know that what it used to be like was going to be important. If I would have known when I was out there that I would be here tonight reporting to you what it used to be like, I would have paid more attention to my life. If I would have known when I was out there that what it used to be like was going to be important, I can guarantee you I would not have done some of the things that I did, but I didn't know it was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. And if you're a blackout drinker, I love blackouts. I really, really love blackouts. I wish we could have blackouts sober. I love blackouts. There's nothing more exciting for me then leaving work on April 14th, going back on April 20th, and discovering you'd been there the entire time. It's just, paychecks come a lot quicker that way. But if you're a blackout drinker and you're not paying attention, it makes what it used to be like a little fuzzy. I had to get a fingerprint clearance for the job that I have. And I fingerprint really well. I'm good at fingerprinting. I roll right along with the printer. I don't go too fast. I don't resist it. I roll right along. But I didn't want to raise any red flags when I was being printed, so I very casually said to the woman doing my printing, I said, well, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. And I thought, oh, my God, it's like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order, because they're going to know about it before I do. And the book Alcoholics Anonymous says more will be revealed. It doesn't say how. So my prints were taken. They would send them off. And I don't know if you have a lot of interactions with non-alcoholic people, but non-alcoholic people, when they're going to give us what they think is bad news, they have a tendency to have a little hesitancy in their voice. And this woman called me up, and she was really hesitant when she called me. And she said, you know, your report came back. And I said, uh-huh. She said, you know, normally these reports are 2 or 3 pages long. I said, uh-huh. She said, yours was 56 pages. Do you want to see it? Well, of course I did. So I went down there and read that report. and I know a lot more about what it used to be like. Having read that report. So the story I share with you, I don't even know if it's true. It may be, I don't know. But I like the story, so I just keep telling it. And here's the way it goes. I didn't have my first drink of alcohol until I was 13 years old. And I'm sorry I waited that long. But I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. I don't remember ever thinking, I can't wait until I drink. I don't remember ever thinking I would never drink. I don't think I thought about alcohol at all. Yet I'm 13 years old. I'm on a camping trip. We're camped on the beach just south of Oceanside. And I remember that Friday night as if it were tonight. I remember getting into that tent, and in my pillowcase I had a bottle of vodka. And I had no idea where that bottle came from. I've always believed it was the grace of God, but I've never been able to confirm that. But I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me, but I remember being excited about having it. And I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around the tent. Nothing had gotten different. Nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about other people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous is I heard you talk about your first drink. And you described the drink. You talked about it. You felt this warmth in your mouth. And you somehow felt it as it trickled down. And it trickled down and it hit your stomach and it exploded. And it went to your fingernails and your toenails and you grew a couple inches, you dropped 20 pounds, your pimples fell off, you became Prince Charles, Lady Di. I mean, wonderful things happened to you. And that wasn't the case for me. I had my first drink of alcohol and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me was I had to go to the bathroom, and it's my belief tonight that if you were to drink a quart of anything in about 15 minutes, you'd have to go to the bathroom. So I get out of the tent, and I shuffled through the sand to the outhouse, and I went in and went to the bathroom, and when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to go use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Later in my drinking, I would discover that two people can use the same toilet at the same time. The second person's got to be really careful, but I didn't know that at 13. I did somehow know that the body was made up of energy, and I somehow figured if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. So I've always referred to it as my first formal meditation, because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the sand, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, when I came to AA, you told me my whole problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have fantasy as in Marines, as being dive-bombed, as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. In my own defense, I always have to tell you my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I've always contended under those circumstances it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch. And quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either, so I got out of there. And that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most amazing, incredible, fabulous, magnificent, wonderful, marvelous, spiritual thing I ever did. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I just recently found out you can buy vanilla extract without alcohol in it anymore, which I think is a total ripoff for our children. I remember the day the guy at the market called me over. He said, Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore. He says, I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do. And I got cut off from that supply. Drank a lot of mouthwash. In fact, I want to thank the committee for the gift. I got a nice gift basket. In my gift basket, I have a little thing of hand sanitizer. I thought, oh, good, a shot. And I just... I used to drink a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I'll tell you what, if you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely and lap at your neck. I have a hard time in Kansas. They wear it a lot there. But you know what? I don't know this is unusual. I don't know that I'm living any different than anybody else. And when you think about it, really, how would we know? I mean, I'm a bar drinker. I'm a bedroom drinker, an alley drinker, a car drinker, a dumpster drinker, a backyard drinker, an alley drinker. I don't really specialize. I just drink. But I love bars. I love sleazy, nasty, disgusting bars. I know there are none here. There's a few in Costa Mesa, but I like those. I like those ones. And there's a few in Sacramento, too. I know that. But, you know, I like those ones that have sawdust on the floor. The mirrors are cracks. You kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. The upholstery around the bar is ripped, or people have tried to hold on as they're falling off their bars. It's always nice if there's a piece of broken furniture somewhere. It's just kind of... And they used to be full of smoke. I understand you can't smoke in a bar in California anymore, which makes no sense to me. I drank in bars where guys would take a piss against the wall. Apparently, they can still do that, but they can't smoke in there. But they used to be full of smoke, and they had that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still. I love that smell. Sometimes if I'm in a cranky mood, I'll go buy one of those joints, open the door, take a hit off of that, and it just perks me up for the rest of the day. I love that smell. But I'm fascinated by the quality of people who drank in there. There were like admirals in the Air Force. There were neurosurgeons. There were bank presidents. There were, I mean, that's what they said they were. And I... We weren't sitting around having conversations like, well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? Well, what's your preference, Chantilly or Aquavelva? I mean, we weren't having those kinds of conversations, so it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body, and from that day on I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. I had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State. I graduated from there with a 3.8 grade point average. I share that with you because it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got here, I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. In retrospect, I can tell you I was a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic. I'm drinking on a daily basis. I'm a blackout drinker. And I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. I stayed at San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I'm one of those people, I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it. Apparently, I do school well. So I stayed and took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. My disease manifests itself in justification, rationalization, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain to you why I'm doing it. As I'm explaining it to you, I'm hearing it. As I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I think I'm leaving San Diego because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I don't think I'm leaving because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. And another resentment I got early in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found out here you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. Who knew that? I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. And here's the thing. I'm driving down the street. The light comes on behind me. I pull over. The officer walks up. Now, the first thing I do is slam my car door open. My intent is to knock him into private parts. Men are a little fussy about their private parts. So as the door is flying open, he jumps back to protect himself. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try and I go for him. And it'd be a really good, I was a lot younger then, but it was a good fight for a couple of minutes. But I wouldn't remember that back at the car, he had a friend. And the friend had a radio. And the friend would call some more friends. And pretty soon, it'd be two or three of them, one to me, it's not fair anymore. I'd say, uncle, and they'd take me away. And the next time the light comes on behind me, I pull over. The officer walks up, I slam my car door open, try and knock him into private parts. He jumps back to protect himself. He gets far enough away and get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me. think I can take him. One of him, one of me. I think I'll try, and I go for him. Good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And pretty soon, four or five of them, one of me, it's not fair anymore. It's handling to take me away. And I didn't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. I never remembered the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time it's a fair fight. This time I'm going to take him. And I don't know if it was a good thing or a bad thing. It just was. I drank during a time when the state of California didn't get their underwear in such a knot about drunk driving. I understand they're pretty testy about it now, but I mean, I never really had any consequence. Well, they took my license from me, but you don't really need that to drive a car. But I paid an attorney $1,000, which was a lot of money. And he'd make a phone call, he'd write a letter, whatever, and that'd kind of be the end of it. I'd never hear any more about it. But one time, I had two pending at the same time, and my attorney was nervous. And I think if your attorney's nervous, you should worry about it. So I'm sitting in a bar worrying about the fact that my attorney's nervous. And I struck up a conversation with this guy sitting next to me, and as luck would have it, he worked in a mortuary. And I came up with a plan. I think alcoholics, I think we come up with really good plans really quickly. Now, the problem for me is typically my solutions are worse than the original problem, which is why today at 36 years sober, I'm still actively sponsored. Because still today, my solutions typically are worse than the original problem. But I didn't have a sponsor then, so I came up with this plan, and we went over to the mortuary. We got a death certificate. We wrote my name on it. We filled out all the pertinent information. We forged a doctor's signature. We sent it to the court. Because they can't expect a lot from you if you're dead. And I called my attorney and told him he didn't need to worry, and he didn't worry. I didn't worry. Nobody worried for, you know what, I don't know what it was, 100, 200, 300, I don't know what it was, days when the light came on behind me again. And I pulled over, and this time the judge wanted to see me. And he never wanted to see me before, but you know what? I'm game. I'll go. And I'll never forget him looking at me. He said, "Miss Ochoa, tell me, how is it a dead person is standing in my court?" And I shrugged my shoulders, and with all sincerity, I looked at him, and I said, "I don't know. Bad luck?" And that's what I thought it was. It was bad luck. It was circumstances and conditions. It was a lot of things. It never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. It never occurred to me. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. And I don't think I'm leaving San Diego because I have one more drunk driving assault charge pending. I don't think I'm leaving San Diego because I have a roommate who's a little annoyed with me. And I know we're not supposed to talk about them, but I have to tell you about my roommate. Even at the height of my alcoholism, I have a tremendous amount of compassion. And I'm sitting in a bar one night, and this guy says something to me I've never understood. He said, "I'm too drunk to drive." Really? So I take him home with me because I have a tremendous amount of compassion. So I take this guy home. We get to my house. I send him into the bedroom over here, tell him I have to go to the bathroom. So he goes into the bedroom on the right. I go into my bedroom on the left, and I have just sent him in with my roommate. Now, lots of times that was okay with her. Lots of times she wouldn't even mind. Other times, within a matter of minutes, there'd be all this banging on my bedroom door, which I had, of course, locked. I have 7 o'clock classes. I've got to get some sleep. And if it would have always been all right or never been all right, I'd have been okay. But she was so inconsistent, you'd have drank if you lived with her. And I don't think I'm leaving because she's a little annoyed with me. I think I'm leaving because I've taken all the classes San Diego State has to offer. I was offered a job in Chico, California, which is about as far north as you can get. I loaded everything I owned into my car. I took some beer, I took some booze, and I headed north. I got to Santa Ana, which really isn't the place you want to... It's not the place you want to shoot for, but I was out of booze and I was thirsty. So I pulled off the freeway. I have a sense I can find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. It was full of smoke. Had that wonderful used booze urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got. 88 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support. And at some point it had turned. and I've always believed it was in the middle of my first drink. At some point it had turned and began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, integrity, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings, and long before I got to you, it had taken it all. Long before I got to you, alcohol controlled every area of my life, where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. And I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know. They didn't know. I went into the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top, and that too almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I got here, I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about, we often gave awards, and because I have a gift, God gave me a gift, we often won awards. And I didn't tell you about the times that I would come out of a blackout, standing behind a podium, much like this, in a room full of people, holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and then somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club. And I didn't tell you that. I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I was in the newspaper business, so we drank. People in that business drink. If you're in that business, you drink. I know probably a lot of nights I didn't want to drink, but I had to go to the bar because that's where the news is. That's where the stories happen. That's where you get the leads. And I'll tell you what, I did get some really good leads in the bars. The problem was I wrote those notes on those little napkins, and the glass would sweat, and then the ink would run, and then in the morning I'm like, trying to read it, and I can't read it, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I've got to go back to the bar tonight. I hope that guy's there again. And you have to drink if you're in there. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered if you work for Bonds, you have to drink after work. If you work for, if you're unemployed, you have to work instead of, go to the bar instead of work. I mean, but I, rationalization, justification, and denial. And one night I left the bar, and I'm on my way home, and I'm turned onto my street, and I always had bad car karma. Just as I turned onto my street, the power steering went out of my car, and I smashed into a car on the left-hand side of the street, and I panicked, so I turned the wheel a little bit, and I smashed into a car on the right, and I smashed into one on the left, and one on the right, and one on the left. Finally pulled into my driveway. I was so relieved I'd gotten home safely. I just sat there in a moment of gratitude, and after a couple of minutes, I went in the house, and I wasn't in the house but a minute or two, and the doorbell rang. And you know, people are always bothering you. They never leave you alone. They always want something. I opened the door. It was the Orange County Sheriff. I said, do you know what time it is? He wanted me to come out on the front yard. I don't want to come out on the front yard. He's insisting, so I'm telling him about my car. He doesn't care about my car. He's pointing to all these cars that are smashed out. And I looked at him and said, and isn't it great I got home safely? And he didn't care. He opened the door to his car, and he wanted me to get in. And I don't want to go on the ride-along. I've been on the ride-along. I don't have time for the ride-along. I'm not going on the ride-along. And he's insisting I get in, and I'm telling him I can't. And he's insisting that I can't. And he's, you know how they are. They're tenacious. They don't let up. And so I said, all right, I'll go on the ride-along. And I hop in the car. Now, I have a reputation as a violent drunk, only I don't know it. But when you get out of the car the way I get out of the car, you get a reputation as a violent drunk. So I hop in the car, he shackles my ankles, he cuffs my hands behind my back, and he starts driving. Well, you know, the sheriff, they have that fence between the front seat and the back seat. What's that for? I mean, he's driving, he gets on the freeway, and I start telling him, hey, wait a minute, you don't go on the freeway on the ride-along, you stay on the surface streets. And he ignores me, keeps driving. I said, excuse me, you don't go on the freeway on the ride-along, stay on the surface streets, and he ignores me. And I don't like to be ignored. So I don't know what happened. The devil flew in me or something, but I just honked up a big one. I just spit right on the back of his head. See, you think it's funny. He wasn't even amused. He just started going faster and faster and faster and faster. And when the speedometer hit 100 miles an hour, he slammed on the brake. And I'm cuffed and I'm shackled and I can't break the fall. I went face forward into that metal grate. And I'll never forget it. My glasses broke. There was blood everywhere. I'll never forget that night. They're taking my mugshot. They kept referring to me as Waffle Face. And I don't know it's alcoholism. I have no idea it's alcohol. It's you and they and them. It's circumstances and conditions. It's a lot of things. Never occurs to me anything to do with alcohol. In 1975, the state of California was starting to get really testy about people barreling down the freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something in the breathalyzer above their grade point average. And I got pulled over one more time, and I was doing the field sobriety test. I'm good at field sobriety tests. I practice field sobriety tests. I have a very high-profile job. The cops are always looking for me. They know what I drive. They know what I drive. If I have my car, your car, company car, a stolen car, they always know what I drive. They're always looking for me. So I get released from jail. I get the arrest report. I read it. I find out where I made my mistake so next time I can get that part right. And I practiced a lot. By what I pray God was my last drunk driving assault charge, I even mentioned to the officer I thought I was doing A-plus work. It was really good. I mean, I touch your finger to your nose. I can tonight I can stand on one foot for 45 minutes. I am good at field sobriety tests. And at the end of the test, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I just confessed, and they cuffed me and took me away. So on the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around, and I said, see, you think it's funny. He wasn't even amused. He cuffed me, took me to Orange County Jail. He put me in a cell with criminals. I mean, real criminals. There were like prostitutes in there. There were women who'd been arrested for beating their husband, which I don't think should be a crime, but in California, they locked you up for it. And I knew I didn't belong there, so I tried to organize a prison break. And I came up with a simple plan. I explained it very slowly to the criminals. An easy plan. We're going to get our coffee cups. We're going to bang them on the bars. And the marshal comes to see what's going on. I'm throwing my arm around your neck. We're getting your keys, and we're getting out of here. I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me, and she said, why don't you sit down and shut up? And I said, fine, then you all stay, but I'm getting out. I was going like a madwoman on those bars. Couple problems with styrofoam cups. The first one is they don't make a lot of noise. Second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. And when the bars ate it up and it got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. I went to court on that charge. I was 26 years old. I was drunk in court that morning. It's the only way we went to court, the laundromat, the grocery store. It's the only way I did anything. I stood there drunk that morning in court. I had the public defender standing next to me the day the $1,000 attorney was gone. The only thing I've wanted to do since I was in the fourth grade was be a writer. I had an opportunity to go into that profession. I gave it up for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. A job and a drink, I took a drink. Anything and a drink, I took a drink. And I'd given up my profession of choice for one more drink. I was unemployed and unemployable. I had the public defender standing next to me. And because the state of California was starting to pass out serious consequences, and because of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. I didn't like him. He didn't do anything. He wept and he cried. You'd think at 8 months old, he could get a little part-time job. I just, but I didn't like him at all, but I was willing to use him that morning. And I told the judge that he couldn't put me in jail. I was a single parent and I was self-supporting through my own contributions. And he told me to put my son in a foster home because I was an unfit mother. And I would have admitted to being a lot of things. I knew I was a lot of things. But I did not believe I was an unfit mother. I had that kid with me every day of the week, whether he wanted to be with me or not. And my son was to spend the first 11 months of his life in one of those plastic things that you put kids in when you don't want to touch them, sitting on a pool table in a smoke-filled bar. But I believe because I had him with me made me a fit mother. My son is eternally grateful for my sobriety. He outgrew that plastic thing a long time ago. And I was being sentenced. And then in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed and the tone of his voice got different. And I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance. And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stood in the courtroom and thought about it. I wish I could tell you I took the alternative and I came here, but I thought about it. Bill writes something in the book Alcoholics Anonymous to this effect. It says something like, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. And Bill goes on to say this is not always an easy choice for us. If you're new tonight, please hear that. This is not an easy choice for us, to be doomed to an alcoholic death. And I don't think by alcoholic death, Bill means have the decency to lay down and have him put dirt on your face. I think the alcoholic death that Bill talks about is to continue to live in the incomprehensible demoralization, to continue to live in the despair, to continue to live dreaming dreams and planning plans and not being able to get off the bar stool and get it done, to continue to live promising the people that we love that we won't do it again. And then we do it again. And we see that look in their eye, that look that says, why did you do it? You promised you wouldn't do it. Don't you love me enough? To see that look. I think that's the alcoholic death that Bill talks about. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. This is not an easy choice for us, and I think that's the choice I was being asked to make that morning. I had what I know tonight is a moment of clarity, because as drunk as I was, I knew very, very clearly that if I went to jail one more time, I'd either die in the institution or I'd become institutionalized for life. I don't do jail well. I hear people in AA talk about they go to jail, they get sentenced to 6 months, and they get out in 3. I get sentenced to 6, I get out in 12. I don't have the social skills even to behave well in jail. And I knew if I went to jail one more time, I would become institutionalized or I would die in the institution. And so I took the alternative. I left the courtroom, and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it had been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day, I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what ANA was. I thought it was something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners. And a lot of days it is. I mean, as far as I know, I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous before. I had no idea what you people were going to do to me or for me. And my first meeting was a speaker meeting. I don't know who talked that night, but I heard 2 things. I heard we don't drink between meetings. I quickly looked around, and I didn't see any of you drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you don't drink in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? And I don't know how that impacts other newcomers, but it made me nervous. I couldn't figure out why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to the Sears School of Safe Driving. I did not understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And the other thing I heard was that the answers were in that book, Alcoholics Anonymous. So after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. And I can't tell you, I was irritated. I went home and read it. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And I'm a thief. It's humiliating for a thief to have stolen the wrong book, but I don't know I'm a thief. My sponsor told me I was a thief. I mean, here's the thing. I'm in a bar drinking. The bar closes. I pick up the keys. I go find the car, and I'm driving myself home. My sponsor in the San Diego police think this is Grand Theft Auto. I think it's alternative transportation. I just need to get home. And rationalization, justification, and denial. And but it's embarrassing for a thief to have stolen the wrong book. So I figure before I go back to court, I'm going to go to AA and get the answer book. So Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. The only reason I came back. I don't think it matters why you come back. I don't think it matters what your motives are, what your intentions are, what your desires are. I think what's important is what your actions are. Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book, and I've been coming back to Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. That meeting was a small discussion meeting, and I heard in that meeting, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. I mean, really, look at the person next to you. Unless you're sleeping with him, what is it? I could not. Couldn't figure it out, and then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants, not like the kids do today. I work with teenagers. I work with teenagers who wear pants that have absolutely no relationship to their body size. They are so big, they could put a homeless family in there with them. But his weren't that baggy, but they were baggy. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly assessed the situation. I figured he's shooting heroin. Folks who shoot heroin nod out, and I can probably do this thing and not drink if I could shoot a little heroin. And so I found out where he worked. I snuck down to his office. I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, so I guarantee you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my job life would get better, my relationships would get better, my family life would get better, my finances would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. So, It's a little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. As I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. See, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going to do something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going to do something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. I don't know good from bad for me. I've gone through times in my sobriety that have been incredibly painful. Life is sometimes painful, not just for alcoholics, but for people. Life is sometimes painful. And I'm rather dramatic, so I refer to it as the dark night of the soul. Unless, of course, you're going through it, then I just tell you to get over yourself. But in those times, if I don't drink and don't die and don't drink and don't die, I get far enough beyond it to every time I've thought my life was falling apart. In retrospect, I see that it was really falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where he'd have me be. So I don't know good from bad for me, but I know different. And it's all different than it was, and I have never had it so good. I came here to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. If a single day in the last 36 years, I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. I believed that old man. I don't know why I believed him, but I hadn't believed a human being in a very long time. It seems to me my entire life people hurt me. They disappointed me and they let me down. My parents told me they loved me anymore, their love, and I'd have died. Their love was physically, emotionally, and spiritually abusive. I came to believe that if I love you, I would hurt you. If you love me, you would hurt me. And I just didn't want to be hurt anymore. I made a decision as a very small child that I don't want to be hurt anymore. And I began to build a brick wall to keep you out. And the wall kept you out. It worked really well. What I didn't know about that wall is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that wall in isolation and loneliness. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be back there. And when you live behind a wall like that, you don't believe and you don't trust. And I hadn't believed another human being in a long time, but I believed that old man that morning. And I didn't know why then, but I know why tonight. I believed him because of the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic talking to another. One alcoholic talking to another goes through that brick wall. And that old man that I thought was shooting heroin was really sober longer than I'd been alive. And he had a serenity and a peace inside. He was right with himself, he was right with God, and he was right with us. I had no idea what that was like. I can tell you tonight, as a result of taking the 12 steps to recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know what that's like, and I have the ability to fall asleep in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I believed him. I already had the books every morning. I'd open it and I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book. And that was reading the book. I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee. On the way out, I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say hi, Patty. That was talking to another alcoholic. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive, but I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. But I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I pray God happens to everybody who's new what happened to me. I've been in pain in the last 36 years, but I have never been in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months away from my last drink. You see, what happened to me is I came to AA. And the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous understood that we share what it used to be like, what happened and what it's like now. And when you shared what it used to be like, your alcoholism touched mine. And when you shared what it used to be like, your alcoholism touched mine, and your alcoholism touched mine, and your alcoholism touched mine. And 8.5 months of sitting with you, your alcoholism woke mine up. And I became an alcoholic in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because the men and women here understood how we share with one another. And as much pain as I've ever been in, I was never in the kind of pain that I was in 8.5 months sober, the pain of not drinking and not recovering. The pain of not drinking and not recovering drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. And the book says this is the first step of recovery. I admitted to my innermost self that I was alcoholic. I think the most powerful prayer we have in Alcoholics Anonymous is a 7-step prayer. The 7-step prayer says something to this effect. It says, God, take all of me, good and bad. How powerful is that for an alcoholic of my nature? Take it all, good and bad. I don't have to judge it anymore. Is it a good thing, a bad thing, a right thing, a wrong thing? Or my personal favorite, my will or God's will? Take it all. Leave me with this. Leave me with what I need to be of service to you and my fellows. How powerful is that? Selfish and self-centered. That's what walked through the door. Now in the 7th step, all I care about is being of service to God and my fellows. And how did I get here? I did very little. I admitted to my innermost self I was alcoholic. I came to believe the people in AA were telling me the truth. I made a decision to do what you said you had done. I wrote about my favorite topic, me. I bored somebody for about an hour and a half having to listen to it. And as a result of those simple things, I'm in a position now where all I care about is being of service to God and my fellows. How powerful is that? And I think too many people leave before that happens for them. I think too many people complicate it and end up leaving Alcoholics Anonymous before they have an opportunity to get to that place where all they care about is being of service to God and their fellows. Steps 8 and 9 for me were conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. If it came between you and a drink, I took a drink. And it wasn't just saying sorry. I'd said sorry all my life. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I'd do it again and get caught. Sorry, sorry, sorry. And then I'd do it again. And it wasn't about saying sorry. It was about living my life differently. And I don't know how to do that. This is the only way I know how to live. I don't know how to live differently than this. But you do. And so I come to AA, and you share what it's like today. And you talk about going to work and not taking a drink. And you talk about being a parent and not taking a drink. And you talk about doing your life and not taking a drink. And you allow me to take your experience out in the world and live it, and it becomes my experience. I am the woman I am tonight because the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous have allowed me to take their experiences out in the world and live them. And I began to get right with the people in my life. I refused to make amends, so I made my list. I was willing, except for my father. I will not make amends to my father. My father is a drunk. He's a violent drunk. I was the object of his abuse. I hate him. I'm not making amends to him. And my sponsor said, that's fine, as long as you're willing to pay the price. Well, I thought, pay the price? I don't want to go to the father-daughter banquet, so who cares? Sure, I'll pay the price. And so I started making amends. I started getting right with the people in my life. And then all of a sudden, I'm in AA for a while, and I notice that people in AA are, like, you're doing more than just coming to meetings. You're talking about going out to coffee after the meeting. You're talking about going to the movies on Friday night. You got friends. I don't have any friends. I think I don't have friends because I don't want friends. But now all of a sudden, I see you guys all sort of have friends, and now I want a friend. So this is how I make a friend. I sit next to you in a meeting. Then the next meeting, I sit next to you again. By about the third meeting, I'm sitting next to you. Now you're my friend. I'm very excited now because now I have a friend. But now my new friend will crack their gum. I think this is hideous. You're a gum cracker. You cannot be my friend. So now I have to have another friend. So now I sit next to somebody else for a meeting, two meetings, three meetings. Now I have a new friend. I'm very excited for my new friend, who's not a gum chewer. And then my new friend will now cross their leg and kick me. Well, now I've picked somebody who's abusive to be my friend. I cannot have an abusive friend. So now I have to have another new friend. So now, I mean, look, the AA is huge. You can do this for a really, really long time. And then one night, I'm kind of chatting it up with my sponsor. You know how you kind of do the litany and run the whole thing by him? And I'm talking, people in AA don't know how to be friends. I'm trying to have friends, but they're like hitting me and they're getting coffee without asking me if they want any, and they're cracking their gum. And all of a sudden, she stopped me and she said, Patty, she said, remember when we were doing your eighth step and you refused to make amends to your father? I said, absolutely. She said, hate doesn't know that it's directed at one person. Hate will spill out into every relationship in your life. I became willing to make amends to my father, not because I wanted to go to the father-daughter banquet. I became willing to make amends to my father because I wanted to have relationships with you. And I began to be a good daughter to my father. And as I was being a good daughter to my father, I started getting friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my very dearest friend, Cindy Martindale, who was my best friend for 18 years. She and I, the book talks about we are people who normally would not mix. We normally would not mix. I called her the princess. She called me the medicine woman. We would go out to the desert for the weekend. I would have a backpack over my arm. She would have a footlocker because she had to have several costume changes. I think self-supporting through your own contributions is work. She thinks it's alimony. We are people who normally would not mix, but the thing that we had in common was our love for Alcoholics Anonymous. What we had in common was our love for Alcoholics Anonymous and the newcomers. And Cindy was my dearest friend for 18 years. And she had had breast cancer, and she had survived breast cancer. And 5 years after she had survived breast cancer, she was diagnosed, her breast cancer came back and metastasized in her liver, and she was diagnosed with liver cancer. And they gave her not very long to live. And she didn't want to be on this planet in that condition. I think she went much faster than she needed to, but Alcoholics Anonymous, you never have to do anything alone. Every time she went to the oncologist, there were at least six of us in the room with her, and this doctor had no idea what was in front of her. She would explain something to the princess, and she would look at me and say, "Well, medicine woman, what do you think about that?" And then I'd have this big spiritual debate with the doctor, who was just going, you know, "Just quit smoking." And on her last visit, Cindy said to the doctor, "You'll be happy to know I've cut down on my cigarettes." But she was at home her last few days at home. On Thursday night, she fell asleep, and she never woke back up. And on Saturday, I was in her room talking to her, and I don't know if she heard me or not, but I said, "Cindy, you go ahead and let go. You need to let go. Michael, your ex-felon fiancé, is in heaven waiting for you. Chuck Chamberlain's there waiting for somebody to come make coffee. You need to let go. We're going to be okay." And about 3 minutes later, with her sponsor in the room, myself, her mother, and another friend, she took her last breath and she left. And I fell to my knees that day, and I knew the pain was so intense that I knew I had just told the biggest lie, because I was not going to be okay. The pain of that was, I'm the little kid that builds a brick wall because I don't want to be hurt anymore. And the pain of that loss was so great that I didn't think I was going to be able to go on. And I didn't know what I was going to do. But my feet are trained. My feet took me that night to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this horrific pain, I tried to build that brick wall back up. And every time I put a brick down, one of you bastards would take it and throw it away. And the pain was, and I finally, an Al-Anon said to me, she said, "Patty, that amount of pain that you have is absolutely proportionate to the amount that you have learned to love. If you could not have that pain, would you give up a single day that you spent with the princess to not have that pain?" And I would not have given up a single day. And I realized that day that the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you have walked into my heart and you have changed my life. And you have taught me that no matter how much pain I'm in any given moment, regardless of the amount of pain that I'm in, that you will be there to take my hand and you will walk with me. And I left that, and that has been the truth for me. And if you're new, I pray God that that's the truth for you. I'm going to tell you a couple of stories and then I'm out of time. I'm probably out of time now, but I'm almost out of oxygen too. My son, who was 11 months old when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I brought him with me. And many of you know Patrick. I brought him with me because I didn't know what to do with him. And you'd take him at the meeting and you'd hold him, and at the end of the meeting you'd give him back to me, and I'd bring him to another meeting, and everything my son knows he learned from you. You taught him how to love and be kind and be caring. You also taught him how to con and manipulate, and I've never been thrilled with that. But apparently you have to take the good with the bad, and if just sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous would have been enough, my son would have never had a problem. But just sitting here isn't enough. You have to do the work. And my son had a journey that he had to go on. And he went to places that alcoholic men go, and he did things that no human being should have to do. And he was 17 years old, and Cindy came out of his room one day with a bag of marijuana, and look what Patrick has. And I have rationalization, justification, and denial. I get into the ring with alcohol, whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. I get into the ring, and I looked at her, and I said, "Oh, that must belong to one of his friends." And there were some other signs and symptoms that were popping up, and I was making excuses for him, and I was justifying his behavior. And they were calling me from school. He wasn't doing well. Well, you know what? He's one of those kids that probably an education's not important. It'll be important to him when he's in his 20s. And I was in the ring with his disease. I was getting beat up really bad. And one night, just before he turned 18, he came home, and bags under his eyes were down to his knees, and God did for me what I could not do for myself. Because I said to him, Patrick, are you loaded? And I wouldn't have asked him that. And he'd heard me justifying all for years, and he said, no, I'm just tired. And I said, well, if you're tired, you need to come home earlier. So you need to make a choice. You can either smoke marijuana or you can live in our house, but you can't do both. And he went into his room, and 10 minutes later, he came out. He had packed a bag, and he'd made a choice. Intellectually, I understand that choice. I have made that choice over and over and over. Intellectually, I understand it. But when your child makes that choice and walks out of your house, my heart broke. If you're here tonight and you believe that you're not hurting anybody, you're only hurting yourself, I want you to know if you have a mother, that it's absolutely not the truth. Because my son walked out of my house and he broke my heart. And I sat on my couch that night. I was 20-some years sober, and I was trying to decide if I should drink or kill myself because I didn't think I could go on. And my son went on a journey that was hideous, and he did things that were hideous, and I was in the ring with his disease for years. And then on October 23rd, 2009, he called me at work, and or 2002, he called me at work, and he told me he needed help, and one more time, God did for me what I could not do for myself. I said, Patrick, I can't help you anymore. Stay where you are. And I called a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I called the biggest goof in AA. But thank God I called somebody who understood the traditions. Because he didn't say, tell the boy to call me. He said, where is he? And I gave him the address where my son was, and he went and picked up a newcomer, and they went and got him, and they brought him to the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the last little over 9 years, you have done with my son what you have done with me for 36 years. You didn't tell him what to do. You've showed him what to do. You have never told me what to do. You have always shown me what to do, and you have shared with me what you have done. And you've allowed me the dignity to take your experience out in the world and live it. And you have done that with my son for a little over 9 years. He and I were sharing at the Canyon Club a few years ago, and he was a 10-minute speaker, and then when he was talking, he talked about the pain of growing up without a father. I never knew that was painful for him. I'm a single parent. I've been a single parent his whole life. But he's talking about the pain of that, and he looked at this room full of 200 people, and he said, but my mother's a blackout drinker, and I may never know who my father is. And I thought, oh, great, you've just outed me as a slut. And it was one of my proudest moments. And when he was born, I can guarantee you, I did not hold him and rock him and look him in the eye and say, oh, honey, one day my proudest moment is when you and I share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, Norm Alfie used to say seconds and inches. Seconds and inches, I'd have missed that moment. If I'd have made a different choice in that courtroom that morning, I'd have missed that moment. I had an opportunity to share at Aoki Pa when he was chair of the conference, and when he introduced the speaker that night, he said, I want to introduce tonight's speaker, my mother and my hero. And I started to cry, and I got up to the podium. I thought, how do you get here from where I was on October 4th, 1975? How do you get here? There's absolutely no way to get here except through the power and the magic of the 12 steps to recovery. 10, 11, and 12 keep me in the middle of you. 10, 11, and 12 keep writing about it, talking about it, make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody who can help. It seems to me the whole secret here is about helping someone else. Seems to me the whole secret is about paying attention to you so God can come in and take care of my stuff. On November 29, 2006, I was in the hospital right over at South Coast Medical Center when my grandson was born. And it was 2009, please forgive me. I was photographing the birth of my grandson, and at one point the doctor looked at me and he said, this would make a good picture. And I know a little about the female anatomy. I'm thinking, this is not a good picture at all. And just about then, my grandson's head was born. And the doctor turned the head, and I looked into the eyes of God. And I realized at that moment that for, at that time, 31 years, you have allowed me to stand here and look into the eyes of God. That you have allowed me to stand in the middle of you and look into the eyes of God. And my grandson was born that morning. He walked into my heart, and he changed my life. My grandson's 5 years old. He's never done a single thing wrong. I have him every Tuesday, and one day Pat called me at work, and it was a Monday. He said, I'm going to be late. Can you pick up Eden? Because that preschool, they charge you $250 a minute if you're late. And so I went to get him that Monday, and he comes running across the room to me, and he leaps up into my arms, and he says, "Grandma, you might be a little confused. It's not Tuesday." Seconds and inches, I'd have missed that. If I'd have made a different decision in that courtroom that morning to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis, if I'd have made a different decision that morning, I'd have missed that. I'd have missed that moment. If you're new here tonight, I can guarantee you, beyond a shadow of a doubt, if you choose to live by spiritual principles, if you sit in the middle of us, if you do the things that we say we have done, I will guarantee you a life beyond your wildest imagination. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I didn't get drunk, my life would get different, and he didn't lie to me. I end with this. I always end with it. I end with it because it's been my experience, and I pray, God, it's your experience. We already heard it tonight when Matt read chapter 5. It's a line in chapter 5 that says, "There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you."